You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well. Hey, it's Digital Noise returning with a big stack of movies and a big slice of Aaron. How you doing?
I got my wheezy voice recovering from a cold.
Man, you've had your wheezy voice more on more shows than you haven't, though.
Well, that's because until recently, I had allergies. And so I would get my wheezy voice like twice a year. And I've gone without allergy attacks for like 8 months. It's been nice because I'm doing the drops.
So have you,
and then I got a legit cold.
Fair. Have you seen the thing now for people with cat allergies? They discovered there is a vaccine they give the cats, and then after that, the cats are no longer will cause allergens to anyone.
All right, we're going to talk about this offline because I am insanely allergic to cats and have been considering getting one of the hairless ones just because I love me cats.
They said they're still like a year away from like making it available, and even then it's not 100% yet, but there was enough to make an announcement. They think that this is going to be released
apparently,
and that's a thing. I'm gonna take all my cats to get it inoculated.
Apparently if I do these drops for the next 2 years, I will then just not be allergic to things. Which, to give context to our lovely listeners how allergic I am, when I saw my doctor after my allergy exam, because I was like, look, damn it, I can't breathe, help. And he didn't actually tell me what I was allergic to. When he looked at the results, he just went, you're the second most allergic patient I've ever seen in my life.
I thought he was going to be like, well, come up out of the water then.
I was like, oh, thanks. Just thank you. Thank you. So I'm allergic to everything.
That must really suck.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Well, anyway, we're not here to be talking about allergic to things, although I think I'm now allergic to at least a few of the movies that we saw. But we are here to talk about home releases. Man, we've got a lot of Asian films to talk about
this week.
And like, while they're a mixed bag, I found something interesting in all of them.
Well, I was happy that it was a diverse set, too. Like, before I actually read the plot descriptions, I was like, oh, I got a bunch of kung fu, and
it's all across the park.
But it's a lot of different types of films.
All across the, much wider variety than we usually have with these things.
And yeah, they're interesting. Is that what we're going into?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're starting, I try and bulk the things together by theme or whatever, and in this case, we're launching with all the Asian films, which we have several, and like you said, it's not just the martial arts films, it's a bunch of different types of Asian movies. But we're going to start off with, of course, the most talked about of all of them, certainly, that I've seen on the internet right now, or maybe even the second most talked about, depending on how you look at it, which would be Master Z, the Ip Man Legacy. Now, this is the Ip Man films have been so popular, starring Donnie Yen. There's been three official ones. There's been like two or three knockoffs.
Yeah, which apparently are terrible.
I saw two of them. I didn't see three of them. They're not terrible. They're just nowhere near as good as the Ip Man films. And then we've got this, which is officially by the same company, but it's a spinoff of Ip Man 3, featuring the guy who's one of the villains from Ip Man 3, sort of a reluctant villain, Chung Tin Chi, who at the end sort of walked off into the sunset all dejected for not being able to beat Ip Man and fighting, and I'm done then. I quit. If I can't do him, I'm not going to be a schoolmaster. So this film features him after that. Max Zhang plays him. He's very low profile. He is operating a grocery store along with his young son. And he ends up getting involved reluctantly in a whole bunch of shit. First off, by defending someone on the street who's being attacked. And then just getting deeper and deeper inside this world of craziness of gangs one of which is run by Michelle Yao, who seems to be the gangster who's like Godfather 3 Al Pacino. It's like every time I get out, they try to pull me back in. Like,
she's clearly, she makes a big deal about legitimizing the organization, but she's still a badass and she's still hard.
Right. You know? And there's drugs going around, and this is where it gets weird. These drugs turn people into rage zombies. Like, I mean, they're zombies, but they're rage zombies like 28 days later, you know? Am I wrong? They get, like, crazy big veins in their face, and they start screaming and running at people to get to, like, bite them and shit. And you're like, okay, those are rage zombies. Like, and it's unlike that. It's it wears off, but it'll kill you, you know? And so he's like, oh, what's going on? And he's dealing with, like, a girl that he used to know who's come back from America, and now she's all westernized and is, like, very disapproving of everything. And there's, like, I'm thinking of the right movie.
Yeah, you are talking about a different movie.
I'm mixing up another thing. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sitting here going, like,
sorry. No. I was adding in something else into that. I'm sorry.
Because the drug is heroin.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Am I mixing up two things?
I think
things?
You're completely mixing up.
I watched
up.
So many goddamn movies.
All right, so, yeah, because what happens
I'm sorry. You go and tell the story then. I'm sorry.
The girl.
It wasn't entirely dissimilar to the plot of that movie.
So
I don't even remember what movie that was.
I'm really glad you realize that, because the entire time you were talking, I was going, wow, I missed a lot of that movie.
Jesus, I can't believe it. I'm like, I need more beer. So here we go.
So basically, the woman he saves is a heroin addict. That introduces kind of the running bad guy, who is that drug lord who
does not turn into a zombie?
Does not turn into a zombie. There are no zombies. Because he saves that woman and publicly beats the shit out of him, the gangster kind of comes after him really hard. And it tracks that as the gangster kind of messes up his life, and he and the gangster have this back and forth, which he ends up moving into the house with the woman and her brother, who he saved, who he owns a bar on Bar Row. And the movie kind of steps up the size as you get into the movie, because at that point, he starts working at the restaurant, and they start touching on both Michelle Yao's attempt to take her crime organization legit, which her younger dipshit drug-dealing brother, who is the guy, hates. And they start getting to the proper what's really going on, big drug dealers moving all the bulk heroin in, as he and them end up going head-to-head. We haven't mentioned yet that, and I'm blanking.
Dave Bautista.
Thank you. Dave Bautista is in this, who actually does a great job. The only problem is that because he's Dave Bautista, as an American watching this movie, it's like, oh, he's the bad guy.
Right.
And
you're like, either he's the bad guy or he's going to end up being the awesome best friend who teams up with the hero towards the end of the
and
film.
You know he's a bad guy, but he still plays the I'm a good guy act for three quarters of the movie. Right. It's not until the very climax that it's revealed. And this is,
it's not a huge shocker.
This is the biggest weakness of the movie. Because Dave Bautista is actually really interesting in it, I would have liked to see more of Bautista as a villain sprinkled throughout masterminding things. So it wasn't a big twist, which we all saw coming.
See, I was the opposite. I was hoping he would end up teaming up with him against the baddies, and there would be a badass sort of like the hero and Dave Bautista back to back fighting off guys and like finding a way for their two styles to like mix, which of course would mean at some point before that there would have to be a misunderstanding where they'd have to fight each other. You know, it's like how superheroes work. You can't have two superheroes in the same movie without fighting each other initially before they figure out, oh shit, I thought you were a bad guy. Okay, well let's go.
That would have been cool, but the trailers for this movie, which played before every We Go Asia movie for like the last 6 months, made it very clear that Dave Bautista was the bad guy.
They also like released really prominently on the internet the final fight of this movie between the hero and Dave Bautista, which is a really amazing fight.
So one thing to call out, this movie is absolutely gorgeous. It drips in color. The cinematography is phenomenal. The first time you really see the club that becomes the central location for like the back half of the film, I rewound it and rewatched the introductory sequence just because it was so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of fights which have some issues, which we'll get into next, along this bar alley where there's, like, it's the 1930s equivalent of that Blade Runner location with neon lights everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It may be the prettiest section of any movie I saw, which is going to be a big statement considering what we're going to talk about later.
The Chinese film industry, first off, is huge. I mean, it's one of the biggest in the world. They pump out movies and to great success. And they have huge backlots, just like Hollywood does. I've seen this exact backlot in like seven movies.
I don't doubt.
But I've never seen it shot this well. And part of the reason is because this is director Yuen Wu Ping, who, of course, is better known for being arguably the greatest action choreographer who's ever lived. Like, the guy is, like, kind of incredible. I mean, a lot of the films that he directed, I mean, you're like, okay, sure, he directed it, but really it's about how he set up these fights.
Yeah.
Like Drunken Master, you know, or Snake in the Eagle's Shadow way back then. He goes all the way back then. But he did, like, Magnificent Butcher with Sammo Hung, Iron Monkey with Donnie Yen, Jet Li, Michelle Yao, and Tai Chi Master and Wing Chun. He did the action choreography on Fist of Legend with Jet Li, which is one of those top 10 must-see martial arts films. He did the martial arts choreography on The Matrix.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, of course, did it on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Kill Bill. I mean, the guy is a legend, not to put too fine a point on it. Part of the problem here, though, is that it feels like this is a movie that should not have very visible wire work in it. But he mixes in his Crouching Tiger wuxia influences into it of style with sort of more hard-edged, straight-up fighting, and they don't really meld well together, for my money.
Yeah, like, I noticed that, too. There is a particular fight, which is the one I was mentioning in that neon location, where the characters are jumping between the signs.
Yeah.
And it's not... It's never Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's not that.
No.
It's still... It's, oh, that guy is just really awesome, believable-ish jumps. But it seems like they were supposed to look like a real jump, but they just didn't get the wire work right.
Yeah, it has that feeling.
Less style and more just, you should have done this stuff.
It has that feeling of weightlessness that you see in wuxia films that, like, is because everybody can kind of hover, slide, slash glide, slash fly, instead of feeling like parkour, which is what it should have felt like.
Agreed.
And, you know, I mean, and even in the fights, there are scenes where, like, when you do wire work, which is in almost every martial arts film that exists, no matter how gritty, realistic it's supposed to be, you know, when someone gets kicked and they fly way back, they fly in a way that arcs them kind of up in the air, and it's very clear that they're on wires. I'm like, okay, like I said, I don't have a problem with that in certain types of films. Here, it just felt distracting. I also found there was a weird amount of seemingly glitchy editing cuts in the middle of the fights, just little tiny ones where it was like, felt like somebody was over-fucking with this movie in the editing room.
I'll admit, I didn't have the issue with the editing that you did.
Yeah.
But the wire work is definitely noticeable. It's weird. It's just enough to take you out.
But that being said, the actual plotting of the fights, the fight choreography, is magnificent, as you might expect. And these are very charismatic actors, very good fights. It's beautiful looking. This whole town is so neat. It's so color saturated. It's just, it really glows.
And the other thing the movie does, it's so pretty and... I don't want to say saccharine, but it's so glowy that the Vietnam films do this too, where occasionally it will get really violent or really dark.
Yeah.
And it's kind of jarring because it's like, yeah, we're joking and laughing. And then, holy shit, they just murdered that woman with a heroin overdose.
Yeah.
Or, holy shit, that person just got their arms cut off. And, like, what the hell?
One part that really weirded me out here was, okay, so Tony Jaa, who's the Indonesian, like, master, is in this movie wearing probably the coolest looking outfit he's ever worn. It's like this black suit with a black fedora. He looks badass. And he shows up, and most of the time he's skulking around the outside. One point he gets into a fight with our lead character. At the end of the movie, I'm like, can anyone please tell me who that guy was? Because he's not working for the bad guys, and he's not working for the good guys. Who the fuck is he?
He is, and I forgot her name. The actress, the lead, the boss of the crime family.
Michelle Yao?
Yeah, he's her fixer.
Is he?
Yeah, he's the one who she sends to go through and resolve issues in whatever way it needs to be
done. That was not made clear to me.
Yeah, it never is. He just kind of, like, shows up and is there backing her play. And
okay, because he just seemed like totally random character out of nowhere.
That's how I interpreted his character, is like her silent henchman, which that is a flaw of the movie. Because it jumps between villains and because it reveals Batista as the villain so late in the game, there really isn't a menace. It's just situations that occur.
Sure. Well, this is from Welgo, who is, like, pretty much the primary source for getting newer Hong Kong, or just in general, Far East releases in America right now. And they've stepped up over the years from being bare bones releases to doing stuff that actually bothers to put bonus features that they put some work into. Now, while there's a whole collection of shorts, like 3 minute or so, or a minute and a half things on here, and it's all been, like, made specifically pointed at English-speaking audiences. It's just little EPKs. I mean, they're fun little bonus features, but there's nothing exhaustive here. But it's still, overall, I think this is a fun movie. It is flawed. It has some really obvious flaws. But I think anybody who's ever followed the career of Yuan Wu-Ping, who, like I said, is responsible for more of the great martial arts films than not, as far as I'm concerned, and that includes The Matrix.
Yeah.
It's definitely a must-watch in that context. I don't think it's as good as the Ip Man films, but it's almost as good.
We're talking about the difference between, like, a 5- and a 4-star movie, you know? Like, it's still a great film, I think.
Well, next up, we're going way back to the beginning of the, well, technically wuxia genre, but I think it's only tertiary to that. There's, like, the last 10 minutes or so has that.
Yeah, it's less wuxia and more kind of just
stage play. Yeah. It's 1973's The Fate of Lee Khan, directed by legendary King Hu. Man, I'm gonna change my name to King Hu. That's awesome. So this is during the end of the Yuan Dynasty, and of course all y'all know what I'm talking about, the Yuan Dynasty. That was fucked up, right? Are you with me, people? Hey, Yuan Dynasty? What are we talking about?
You act
here
as if we should know, and let's be honest, none of us do, but also the movie begins with a 4-minute explanation of what this is, too.
True. And even then, we're like, I don't understand what that was. Sorry, we're dumb white people. Like,
put it this way, it's the 1300s in China. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm sure people in China watch, like, The Patriot and go, I have no fucking clue what's going on here. So, to be fair. There's this inn that's really cool. It's built into a cave. Like, they built it inside a cave, which is awesome, kind of me. But you never, it doesn't look that way. It doesn't look like it's in a cavern, but it's like they built it under a rock face and stuff. And it's very popular, although it's in the middle of the desert, as near as I can tell. But it seems to stay crowded. And it follows the innkeeper and, who is like a not general. He's like a, I don't know, some officiary in the military.
He is, the innkeeper is a member of the Chinese resistance.
Right.
Because, like, this is in the period of time after, like, 2 generations after Genghis Khan took over, like, all of the known world at that time, and they controlled China, and this is, like, 40 or 50 or X number of years into the Chinese rebellion, which is why everyone's wearing fantastic hats in this movie.
Right, they really are.
I fucking love the hats in this
movie. The first, like, hour of this film is, like, a stage play comedy, like, comedy of errors. It's like Oscar Wilde's The Fate of Lee Khan.
It's about running a hotel mixed with little spurts of kung fu. So, like, the real plot is that the Mongolian general Lee Khan has his sister has obtained a battle plan map of the Chinese resistance, and they're like, fuck, the bad guys have this, we have to get it back or else our resistance is done.
Yeah,
they know that he's coming through this hotel, they know that he's going to send his agents to this hotel at some point, and so they put in sleeper agents, so all the staff working at this hotel, the owner of the hotel, are all kung fu expert Chinese resistance going, at some point, this guy's going to show up.
Right.
an hour into the movie.
And there's and then there's other sleeper agents who are there. I mean, you could over to explain the plot of this movie. It would take a while.
Well, that's about as far as I think you need to get.
The movie ends up... I didn't find it... Outside of the background history, I did not find it overly complicated. No. And I genuinely was enjoying the fuck out of, like, the just hijinks at the hotel.
It's funny. The little snippets of Kung Fu are kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then he shows up and... Like, people start getting beheaded left and
then
right.
It gets Agatha Christie-ish.
And then in the last 10 minutes, it's a kind of a wuxia movie.
Yeah, there's like... Which, apparently, King Hu was very against. He did not want that whole big martial arts sequence at the end. That was not part of his plan, and I get the feeling he didn't even shoot it, from what I've read.
Which makes sense, because it's very different from the rest of the movie.
But he has talked about it since, about, like... Okay, I was there, I was involved, and I made some shots that they kind of edited, they did more filming for, but there's a lot of shots of that are super wide, which is unusual for, like, these films at that time, that was kind of new, where, like, really wide shots of the fights going on. It was meant to really make it feel like how big and empty the space was, that are interesting. There's a booklet that comes with this. It's actually really interesting, talking about all the minor details of this. But even though most of us have not heard of The Fate of Lee Khan, who are English-speaking listeners at the very least, and I suspect many of our like, Asian listeners as well, or, like, I don't know that movie. Yeah, this was apparently kind of a game changer when it came out.
My Chinese au pair, when I showed her, I was like, yeah, like, half the movies I have are Chinese. Yeah. She looked at this and went, oh, this is old.
How old is she?
She's 26.
Oh, well, so. There you go. Yeah. Not really a film buff then.
No. You mentioned that they do some great wide shots, which that happens in the last, like, that final action sequence. But the rest of the movie, they do not do a good job of really conveying the wide open expanse that they're in. I ended up feeling kind of claustrophobic.
Well, you're supposed
they were outside of the hotel.
Oh, okay.
When they were in the hotel, I was like, supposed this to is be a dynamic location and it's fun. There's stuff happening at different levels.
It's a well-designed, well-shot, but, like, single inside location.
Yeah, but every time they were outside, it felt like they were shooting, like, in the random spaghetti Western Italy.
Well, that was the thing.
They were shooting all medium shots and close. It felt
very jarring because, like, you had kind of settled into this, oh, this is a really funny stage play type thing, and I was enjoying it quite a bit on that level, and then for it to completely change its dynamic in the last 10-15 minutes was like, why didn't you find a way to just make all this happen inside the hotel?
That's the thing, like, the movie ended up, I respect it, but as far as enjoyment, it was okay. Every time they were in the hotel, I was genuinely entertained.
Yeah.
And every time they were out of the hotel, I, for the most part, was like, well, this is all right.
The martial arts even were okay. They were better than a lot of the martial arts I've seen in films this early from Hong Kong. Because a lot of them, you're just like, okay, you can see every little miss and everything. And he actually did some entertaining, had some entertaining ideas for the fights.
They were good in concept, but they suffer from the issue that some of the movies of this time period had, where it feels like a dance. It doesn't really feel like a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can tell that, okay, we make this move, we pause. We make this move, we pause. We make this move, we pause.
Right. Well, I don't mind that if it's done well and has a lot of original stuff in it. And I felt like this was one where it was done well and there was a lot of stuff I'd never seen before going on during it.
They threw in some some bow work with bow and arrow and some weapons. It was really cool.
Yeah. So this is a gorgeous case for this thing with inner artwork as well and a booklet and some nice extras. There's The Fate of King Hu for 16 minutes. Sit down, interview, and discussion with the head festival programmer, David Willens, and the festival director of the New York Asian Film Festival, talking about the filmmaking production history of this. There's The Fate of Lee Khan, Film Movement USA release trailer, which is brand new reproduced trailer for this, and then there's the original trailer. But I watched the interview, and it's really insightful and interesting to watch these guys talk about this. I mean, as much as, and I probably more than most people I personally, at least in my life personally know, have watched more Chinese films a lot, including stuff from the 70s. these guys know about a billion times more than I do.
One thing I wanted to call out, this is Film Motion. You mentioned in our last one.
Yeah, well, go.
When we did Heroes Shed No Tears,
yeah.
We were really hoping they started doing this. Here you go. Maybe they listened.
So I actually sent a message to the rep who handles Film Movement. And when I sent in the review for A Hero Shed No Tears, I was like, hey, just want to let you know I'm really impressed that Film Movement's moving in this direction. I think there's a lot of uncovered ground here. There's a lot of films that nobody else seems interested in releasing that are amazing and significant. And the problem is that nobody is focusing on the mid-80s to mid-90s period of Hong Kong, which has hundreds of astonishing films that are regularly referenced that nobody has put out any release of with subtitles in
ages.
15 years.
Yeah.
And certainly not since Blu-ray. I was like, if you could send a message saying there's a giant contingent of film fans that would love to see re-releases of more than just, you know, I mean, like Criterion put out the first two Jackie Chan police story films. So you're like, okay, guys, now 19 yeah. more great Jackie Chan films to be released to go. And nobody's putting out these Sammo. Like, I was like specifically mentioning Counters of the Spooky Kind, which I know sounds ridiculous. Great Sammo Hung horror comedy movie.
I want the Bride with White Hair movies.
The Bride with White Hair, great example. Or they did, somebody did relatively recently put out a box set of the Chinese ghost story films, which are absolutely incredible. Yeah, and they're great. They're totally worth owning. But even then they were not the best possible. It was kind of bare bones, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, but where's my giant fucking Blu-ray box set of Once Upon a Time in China series? Or how about the entire Mr. Vampire run? Where are those? I'm like, Film Movement, you've always been trying so hard to find what is your niche? What is the thing that's going to get you? And they've been relying, falling back really hard on, let's face it, honestly, pretty dry indie foreign films that got played at like 8 festivals in Germany and then are going to like dissipate in the wind.
I'm really waiting for you to get to his response, and I'm hoping, just wait.
No, he was like, that's really fascinating. I actually know the guy who runs this, and I will pass along your words to him.
Ooh.
Yeah. I was like, he's like, that's good info to know. And I was like, I hope he took me seriously, because there is a huge niche. And I know Film Movement has been struggling to try and find out their identity. Like, they need to have something that gets, you know, that has more of a populist bent. And I don't know who, honestly, of every single person I know who loves and is kind of a snob about indie films, who loves the type of films Film Movement do, they don't buy DVDs and Blu-rays.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah. I'd buy those Chinese releases.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. I would buy those Chinese releases. Exactly. All right. So let's move on to another Far East film, The Island. Talk about very, very different. This is a Chinese fantasy comedy drama. And honestly, this film doesn't know what it wants to be completely, although at points it specifically nods towards Lost.
Well, actually, so I watched this movie with my au pair, because she actually saw this movie in China.
Oh, no shit.
At least originally. And
she's like, I can't believe you have this.
Well, yeah, she was like, oh, cool. And we sat down, and 5 minutes into the movie, when they're on the island, I paused it and turned to her and went, so is this like just a survival movie, or is mystical shit happen like in Lost? And she was like, no, it's a survival movie. And I was like, oh.
I mean,
okay.
It's it's bizarre enough that I would argue that it's fantasy. It's fantastical. Fantasy,
it's magical realism.
It's magical
realism. It's kind of like the Chinese Lost big budget equivalent of the one where there's the dead guy who keeps farting.
Swiss Army Man.
Swiss Army Man. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, basically, I guess I'll just jump right into it.
Do it.
The movie begins with a
because obviously I shouldn't be doing the synopsis, because I'm like, and then zombies appear.
There are no zombies in this movie.
No, there were zombies.
So the movie begins with an acknowledgement that there's a giant meteor coming and it might hit Earth. And we switch to the group of characters. It's a corporate retreat. They're going on a team builder.
In one of those duck buses.
In a duck bus, yeah. Which was weird. And it introduces us to the various characters. The boss is there. There's a security guard, the bus driver, and like 20 or 30 people.
And it's a huge cast.
Yeah. While they're on this trip, theoretically, The meteor hits, a giant wave hits him. And there's a 5 minutes overblown effect sequence where they're going underwater.
It's not great.
Everywhere.
It's not good.
It's not great. It's, yeah. Okay.
Entertainingly bad.
And they end up crashing onto an island with no help, going, well, shit, I guess the world just ended. Oh, yes. And 5 seconds before the wave hits, the kind of sort of main character gets a notification on his phone that he's won $60 million
in their currency in the lottery.
So the movie then shifts into them over the course of about half of a year to a year on this island, and they immediately break up into tribes.
It gets Lord of the Flies.
It gets very Lord of the Flies.
/ Gilligan's Island.
There's a lot of discussion on different mentalities of living on the island and like how a society should run.
I mean,
the filmmakers are clearly into discussing the different ways to run a society.
There is a subtext here that is not deeply explored, but it's there of a socio-political analysis of the ways that a society is run well or run poorly. That at points, of course, takes its stabs at capitalism, like every Chinese film made today does, but not. It never gets overblown with it. It's like there. This film desperately more wants to just entertain than it wants to get it serious.
It has really weird tonal shifts. It'll get dead serious. Weird,
yeah.
It'll get super goofy, and it kind of follows that lotto winner and his brother as they go from group to group to eventually on their own, even to being instrumental figures on the island. And as these group of people learn how to adapt and survive, this movie, if I had to describe it in a single word, is overbloated. You could easily cut an hour out of this, I think, 2.5 hour movie, at least a good 30 to 45 minutes, and it would have been a better movie for it.
Oh, it is so long. Oh my God.
And it doesn't need to be. The humor does work in a lot of parts. 134 minutes. There are some interesting stories. Although the main character, and this is probably a cultural thing because we are definitely going through I hate to keep referring to it as a Me Too shift, but we're definitely coming in through a phase in our country where we're aware of how men treat women. And man, the main character is the quintessential nice guy. He is such a shitty dude through the first half of this movie that when he becomes a more sympathetic character and becomes a genuinely good guy, I kind of almost didn't care. I had some problems with that in the movie.
I don't feel like the movie is entirely clear on what it wants to do with those things. It definitely calls the guy out to some extent for this stuff, but it's just so convoluted and overlong and wants to stuff more shit happening than the film needs to have happen. This film is kind of best experienced as a WTF watch, you know?
It's interesting. I was not too long ago, I was watching this YouTube channel, and he was talking about a problem in Chinese cinema today, and how Chinese cinema is largely, they've hit on the idea that American movies are profitable and do well globally, and so they've learned a lot of lessons from American filmmaking, and how it's to the detriment of Chinese film because they do these big effects movies and they don't have the infrastructure to do the effects well enough. And they're also tending to go overblown and goofy. And this movie feels like somebody who watched Pain and Gain and the Michael Bay movie and went, I'm going to make this about a group of people on an island, but a little less extreme because it feels like Michael Bay trying to make a family friendly movie. But everyone's Chinese.
And it's not all that family friendly overall.
No, it's not.
But it's not. There's elements of this that I found really entertaining and cool and even original. And there's a lot I'm like, why is this here? And once again, when the fuck is this wrapping up?
Yeah.
And the things I admittedly, as someone coming in from the outside, what found most entertaining is there's a polar bear sequence that's lost nod. There's another nod that's obviously supposed to nod towards the smoke monster sequence in the first episode of Lost.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is funny that it's there, but were the Chinese really into Lost? I don't know.
Well, you know, it's funny. Like, if they had actually gone kind of mystical with it, I probably would have been far more with the movie. But yeah, because there was none of that in it.
It's socio-political humor, and a lot of that is applying to stuff that we're not immersed in by the culture of China. So I felt like I was missing a lot of stuff there. I mean,
clearly, there's a lot of stuff going on right now with the protests.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a lot more relevant if we're steeped in their culture. My au pair seemed to enjoy it for the most part, and she had no problem sitting down to watch it a second time. So
I will say, cultural disconnect. The girl who is the main character, sort of like love obsession, is Shu Qi, who is one of the most recognizable Chinese actresses in the world, certainly one of the highest paid Chinese actresses. You've seen her, you know, in fact, as of 2014, I believe she is the highest paid Chinese actress. You've seen her in tons of stuff.
Wait, was she somebody like disappeared for a bit and then reappeared?
No, I think that might be someone else. I'm not sure. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's her. But she was in like Journey to the West with the big Stephen Chow movie, which is certainly well worth your time. But she was also in The Transporter.
Yeah,
you know, you believe me, if you've seen, if you watch movies regularly, you'll go like, wait a minute, I know her. Who is that?
And she's good in the movie.
She is. She's
one of the more enjoyable parts.
She's got this,
she's a bigger character.
She's got this very unique look to her. There's something. She's one of those je ne sais quoi actresses. You're like, I don't know what it is you have, but you've got something that you never forget her when you see her. And she honestly is a high point here. But at the same time, you're like, I wish the story was following her instead of this dude who is like, in not a good way, crushing on her.
It was like watching The Passengers, where it was like with Scarlett Johansson, I think.
I don't know.
Mystique from X-Men, where like you're following the wrong character. You're following a guy who's creepy and did creepy things and is trying to get better.
I would rather see the other
one. I want to watch her story.
Yeah, it's like it feels like you're being apologetic for this guy that, like, I mean, while I certainly am not of the mindset of, and no one can make any mistakes ever, so fuck them.
Yeah.
I don't think we're really in the climate right now of, like, let's watch them and feel bad for them.
Well, personally, I don't think that he had enough of a journey to come back from that. Like, you're right. I think it's important in cinema to show that people can make mistakes, both in real life and in movies, and come back and recover and still be decent human beings, but you got to earn it and you got to put in the work.
Agreed.
And he just was okay then.
And I believe that was a Wellgo release, as is this next one, which is actually from South Korea, The Swindlers. Now, this is interesting because I'm reasonably sure I have never seen an Asian big elaborate Confidence Man movie, in the style of the American Confidence Man movie.
I have. In this show, actually.
Did we? Maybe I'm just forgetting.
I have a complaint about this movie that I have felt against all of the movies of this ilk that I've seen from Asia, which, okay, shit, I jumped into it too soon. I never understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, watching this movie, I can go in and try to explain the plot, but, like, for at least two-thirds of it, I was like, I legitimately don't know what's happening. It's fun.
I agree.
But so basically, in the beginning of the movie, this confidence man has stolen $4.2 billion, I'm going to call it dollars, but some currency.
Yeah, a lot of money.
And has disappeared. And the movie jumps 4 years later. People are still looking for him. He's rumored to have been dead. And it follows a district attorney?
Well, it follows a couple different characters.
A district attorney.
Like, I think he's like an assistant DA or something.
A con man whose father was found dead in the bad guy's run.
So the bad guy was responsible for the death of his father.
And two other characters who I can't tell you if they were police or what. But basically, this group of four characters get together in order to find this man.
Well, yeah, okay, so first off, we should
say, you're gonna have to take over from there, because I don't know that I can explain
that. We should say that, like, it was believed, like, enough evidence was shown that this guy died after he escaped, that the police have just gone like, okay, well, he's dead, so there's no point in pursuing it. So these characters, like, found evidence that he is definitely not dead. Like, the younger, the son of the other con man who was killed by the villain con man, you guys are already confused, I can tell, is like, no, I actually went there looking for him, and I found him, and he let me go. And it was like, okay. So now they're like, okay, we're going to form a team and we're going to use our fucking X-Man con man skills together to take out this, to get, call this, make this guy come out and reappear to get him. And of course, as it is, and honestly, it was one of those, like, I didn't know whether or not to really expect it because it's a Chinese version. I'm like, are they going by American South Korean? Are they going by American con movie rules? But yes, they are, of the whole, nothing is as it seems.
Yep, there's a con within a con within a con. Yeah. Everybody's conning everybody else at the same time.
Exactly. So it's like, and it just gets more and more complicated.
And like, like, I legitimately still don't understand two-thirds of this movie. But having said that, it is stylistic, it is well acted, it is well shot. I had fun, even though I don't know what the hell was happening, really.
I mean, I think like our last one, this also suffers from being overlong and too drawn out. There's too many threads going too many different directions that are there largely for the attempt to mislead you. And I get it. The hardest film in the world to write successfully has to be a confidence film.
Yeah.
Has to be, right? So few people have ever done it like 100%. Like maybe, what is it? House of Games and The Spanish Prisoner, both David Mamet films, Ocean's 11.
I was going to say the Ocean series.
That's just the first one.
Okay, fair enough. Even though I kind of dig part two a lot.
Yeah, but you got to admit, it's not even close to the first one.
The first one.
I mean, there's not a lot of truly amazing, like, confidence films that where you're like, oh, that worked perfectly all the way through, and very few hold up to a second viewing.
Yeah.
You know, The Illusionist is a good one.
Usual Suspects.
The Usual Suspects.
Yeah. But, humorously enough, this movie also has an actress in a side part who is my favorite character in the entire movie, and was actually in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I'm pretty sure. I think it was her.
Who are you thinking of?
The female character.
They're Korean actresses.
No, I was completely mixing her up with somebody else.
I was going to say, that seems unlikely.
And then the zombie showed up and ate everyone, and then they became cured.
Oh, yeah, that's what happened. I don't know. I'm with you. I think this is very well shot. It's got a bunch of very young, attractive actors in it that are, like, a little bland at times, but like none of them I thought found particularly distinctive, but none of them are bad.
It also occasionally goes really dark. Like it begins with a sequence of people realizing that their life savings are gone and people start killing themselves. Like the opening of this movie is just bleak as all hell. And so it took a while for me to not be like, oh, this isn't a super dark, messed up film. This is lighthearted. Okay, cool.
Yeah,
I'm here.
It starts kind of brutally. You're not wrong. But, you know, I mean, it wants to be more of a fun movie than it ends up being because of its painful running time.
Yeah.
And very confusing plot dynamics. I mean, it was very there were a couple parts. I almost never have to do this. I had to rewind and go, I did not get that at all. I'm having to go like 20 minutes back just to try and get a grasp on what the fuck is happening. Yeah. And that is, like I said, in the native Chinese or Korean, this might be much more simple to understand. This particular version of it we're seeing here, whether it is the fault of the subtitles or whether it's just the fault of, it's just not easy to translate this stuff, period. I don't know, but I can say that I ended up going like, I don't know. I mean, part of the frustrating part is that it ends on a, well, we didn't really resolve this, so we're setting up the sequel. And I was like, don't do that.
It ends on a, it wraps up a side aspect of the main story.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, what
wraps up the story that you didn't know was the story until the last 10 minutes, like con movies do. And then it's like, oh, yeah, that other thing that the whole movie has actually been about is still a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's like just like the island, there's only a trailer here. There's no extras. What did your au pair think of this one?
She didn't see this one.
She's like, that's fucked in Korea.
No, she saw the island and the one we're about to talk about next, I would imagine.
Yes. And the one we're about to talk about next is, I believe, our pick of the week.
Yeah.
I know. You were like, I don't know.
I was torn because I really liked It Man, but I do think this is the better film overall.
Okay, so we are talking about Zhang Yimou's Shadow. Now, before we get started, I do have to address Zhang Yimou as much as All right, so we've talked about Wuxia several times during the show, and Wuxia is the sort of a fantasy, very dance-like often, but not always, genre of martial arts films that involves, like, people can fly or jump really hard and high, and they have sometimes they have magic powers, and it's a fantasy-driven, to various different extents, versions of martial arts films. And it's evolved quite a bit. Like, you look at the Fate of Li Khan and say, this is a Wuxia film. And then you look at Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and say, this is a Wuxia film. You're like, what the fuck happened between those two movies?
Or even look at The House of Flying Daggers, which was one of his earlier movies, which is a Wuxia film.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, there have been a couple landmark films along the way. Warriors of Magic Warriors of Magic Mountain was one of the most important ones that made the straight up Lord of the Rings territory stuff, where it was like everybody's throwing fireballs and shit and they can straight up fly, that really kind of changed the genre specifically. But the modern age of Wuxia films, two directors are most responsible for it: Ang Lee with his Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Zhang Yimou with Hero specifically.
Yep.
Now, he's done a lot of great movies that were not this, like Red Sorghum, which was his first movie, or Raise the Red Lantern, but he's always going to be known at most for his contributions to this genre, including, like you said, House of Flying Daggers. He tried to cross over to America more with his The Great Wall.
Yeah, he makes historical fantasy, because, like, Hero is very much based off of a real time period. You know, House of Flying Daggers are real places. The Wall, and then now this, they're all based on real time periods in history, but they're very much, all of them, fantasy films.
Most Wuxia is, you know, based on very specific events, and but what if people could fly?
Yeah. and I have to admit, he's a filmmaker who, at least I haven't seen some of his movies. I've never seen...
if you haven't seen A Woman, a Gun, and a Noodle Shop, which is his kind of Agatha Christie movie, it's great. Came out a few years ago.
Haven't seen Curse of the Broken Flower.
Not one of his better ones.
But
Hero is a... essential Chinese film watch.
I would actually argue House of Flying Daggers is, which is my favorite of his.
I think Hero's so much better myself.
God, I love House of Flying Daggers.
Hero to me was like a game changer. I was like, wow, I thought I liked Crouching Tiger. I think this might be better.
It is.
Like, it's really good.
We're discussing Hero now instead of the one we're supposed to, but I think it gets bogged down in that it kind of justifies a dictatorial takeover of China, which makes it weird-ish.
It's Chinese films, man.
But
there's always going to be, like, from an American standpoint, what the fuck political messaging.
No, I remember when it came out. Like, it got a lot of heat in China because of that. Because people were going, like... Yeah, this guy kind of butchered people. Are we sure we want to tell people that he was right?
Yeah, it's hard for me to gauge these films from a viewpoint that is political, because I don't live in China, and I'm deeply unfamiliar with
pure
the history.
Fantasy for us.
Yeah, for us, it's just pure fantasy.
Anyways, so all of that's talking about Zhang Yimou. So he does modern day Wuxia, which.
He was one of the major game changers. Now, the reason I really wanted to talk about that is because. He was so well known for his use of colors, which was astonishing. Like, especially Hero and House of Flying Daggers, the colors are incredible.
I mean, 4K copies of those.
In Hero, the colors are part of the plot.
Yeah.
Like, he uses it in a way that is distinctively, that imagery, that use of color is part of the storyline, and it's astonishing. It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. Shadow takes a weirdly oppositional viewpoint to that, where he experiments with a film that's not black and white, everything is in deep shadow.
So it's black and white.
It's black
for blood.
It's
and kind of maybe skin tone,
but not like Sin City.
No.
I mean, it's not strictly speaking black and white, but it's shot in this totally desaturated way.
Right. There is elements of color, but it's so extreme that I mentally file this in the world of black and white modern day movies.
Okay. So what's it about?
Okay. So,
God damn it. You just tell me before we recorded. I had trouble understanding what happened in the beginning. I'm like, I can't wait to put him on the spot.
One of the reasons why I was a little hesitant about this being the pick of the week was because, like, the first 30 minutes are... are dense and are basically what's going on is there is a holy city, which is the MacGuffin of this movie, which is really actually unimportant for the movie itself.
Jingzhou.
And then there are three warring countries that are all vying for control of this city. Before the movie happens, one of them ousted the other, and then they teamed up with an alliance to keep the third out. The third is not a factor in this movie whatsoever. And so it begins with the general of the losing side going back to his king and going, look, I just went to their king and challenged him to a duel. If I win, we get the city. If they win, we're done with. Oh, and I probably can't win. and the king tears into him, reveals himself to be a vapid, spoiled king who just likes to be mean for the sake of being mean, or so we think. And then the movie follows the general, and we find out...
He's a zombie?
Yeah. We find out that the character who we thought was a general is the titular Shadow. He is someone who was kidnapped as a small boy because he looks like the actual general and has been raised in secret to serve as his doppelganger. The general a year prior was mortally wounded in a battle with the opposing army against the king himself, and is now using this guy in his machinations, and is a fucking evil bastard.
Yeah, he's also like, kind of just kind of gone batty.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like he's a crazy feeble man, and his wife and the Shadow are basically manipulating events, and the general is manipulating everyone to institute a takeover of this city and probably of quite a bit more. And so it follows the Shadow, who has been told, if you win this battle that you're not going to win, I'll let you go and you can go back to be with your mother, who you haven't seen in 20 years, and you're free. And that's kind of the motivations of the film itself. It follows the Shadow preparing for his duel and learning a quote-unquote feminine fighting style,
yeah,
with umbrellas. Ooh,
death umbrellas.
Which are fucking cool. Even though I wanted them to be used to mess people up a lot more than they were.
Still pretty cool.
But they're amazing. And it's building this back and forth. Everyone's manipulating everyone. The king is also descending into... I'm a vapid, spoiled king ruining my kingdom. And it tracks all of these characters as it leads to the inevitable duel. And shit hits the fan and everything goes down at once. And the movie gets super
crazy. Yeah, if you were worried about like the first 40 minutes of this film, which is very Shakespearean,
yeah,
is what it's going for. It's very Shakespearean dense. Drama. It's dense. But I didn't have any trouble understanding it. I was with three other people in the room, so I was like, couldn't get distracted by anything else, or I'd be that jackass, yeah, checking his phone. So I was just like, okay, I'm really focused when I originally watched this. Because we reviewed it on Highly Suspect Reviews. But excuse me, Jesus Christ, I am so sorry. That never happens in Shadow, I don't think. It does happen in a lot of Chinese films. I found this sumptuous and gorgeous, and honestly my second favorite film by this director after Hero. I think this thing is groundbreaking for this genre. Nobody has tried to do a lot of the stuff he's doing here. I like that he's confident enough to just create this political but still character-based drama for half the film, and then turns it into one of the most incredible-looking martial arts films we've, yeah, seen in 10 years. It's just... Yimou knows how to shoot stuff like almost no one in the world knows how to shoot stuff.
And it needs to be called out. It is actually part of the plot that it is raining this entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
And so every single outside shot is just pouring rain. The black and white is gorgeous.
It's incredible.
The locations are amazing.
Yeah. The city, you see why they want to take it over, because it's like, wow, this place is crazy.
I had a couple of issues. The king, not the the quote-unquote enemy king,
right.
But their ruler, he becomes a bigger character in the third act, and I didn't feel like I spent enough time with him to understand who he really was. It was hard for me not to go like, oh, this is this person I see in the beginning is who you actually are. I would have liked more time seeing the real him. And one thing to call out, this movie is bloody. This is Zhang Yimou making a arty grindhouse movie. Like,
I don't know if I'd go that far.
Well, I see that because, like, nobody dies pretty.
No.
Everybody who dies, there is blood, guts, and gore. And there's a point in the movie where you really question if a single character is going to survive this movie.
True.
It is mean-spirited and nasty and gruesome.
Once again,
and I say this, by the way, as a compliment. Mm. I loved that about this movie. It felt like the great genre movies that we get where, because the stories are more outlandish, you can get away with that kind of thing. And there's a couple of character turns in the last third that are really obvious.
Yeah.
But one thing that I do love is that, and this is such a small moment so I can talk about it, like they reference in the beginning that there is a character who is building up to the most important moment of their life. And this whole movie, and that character, by the way, is a tertiary character. And this whole movie is a build up to that moment. And it was like, oh yeah, I see what you did there. That was cool.
Can I say the most remarkable thing about this home release is that Welgo, who's putting this out, put this out in 4K. Because there was so much demand.
Well, it deserves to.
I mean, people were like, please, please, please put this gorgeous movie out in 4K. And they did. And guess what? They fucking knocked it out of the park. Like, there is such a distinctive difference between the Blu-ray and the 4K version of this. Like, you were completely, like, not often with the 4K films. Like, most of the time, you're like, yeah, I can kind of see the difference. You can tell the difference here.
As someone who doesn't have a device that can run 4K, bite me.
I don't know what to tell you. You could more easily afford it than I could.
It's fair. It's fair. I need the player. I have the TV.
To be fair,
I need the player.
This is my whole job. I had to convince my wife. It took like 6 months. I was like, we need a 4K TV and player. We need one. It's my job.
You know what's even worse is that my parents got a small TV that was too, it was the wrong size for what they need. So they're going to give it to me as a second monitor. It is also 4K. So in the next month, I'm about to have two 4K capable TVs with nothing in my house that can actually play 4K.
The players aren't that bad, but I highly recommend you stick with Sony for the player.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of shitty players. Sony appears to be the only one that's getting top marks.
I might ask you for a recommendation after this.
Fair enough. Anyway, that's it for our first Aaron episode. We're actually going to record two back-to-back here, put the next one a couple days later, because, you know, I like to stick to around an hour. This does remark a strange point in Digital Noise history. The only time we've ever had an episode that were entirely Asian films.
I was going to say, it's the Asian invasion.
Yeah,
as soon as I say that sounds really inappropriate. I'm sorry.
I was going to call it Journey to the East.
I far prefer that. It's Journey to the East.